Okay, so Krishna asked me to talk about low X physics, but true to his motto that physics in Rig era is not necessarily Rig physics, he asked me not to talk about heavy ion collisions. So being a theorist, for me the most interesting aspect of low X physics is physics of saturation, and that's what I want to talk about. And I'm sure many of you during the last couple of years heard tens and hundreds of talks maybe on this subject. So I decided I will talk about a little bit different aspects of saturation physics which have not been discussed a lot and in fact have not been understood until quite recently. And that may be interesting. Actually during Brian's talks, to my great surprise, I discovered that I may be able somehow to relate to his talk, especially to his question whether saturation can provide some kind of a continuity between hard and soft physics. But to get to the point that I want to talk about, let me start with a sort of a brief, biased mini review of the saturation. And for many of the theorists, the trigger, the thing that triggered interest in small X physics was deep inelastic scattering. That's sort of a good example to start the discussion. So just to remind you, this trivial cartoon here, we have an electron that scatters off a proton, actually emitting this virtual gamma, and in the simple parton model, you think of this virtual photon as just basically counting the number of partons inside the proton. So the cross section for this kind of process is just proportional to the size of your gamma of your probe, 1 over q squared, times the number, the probability that it will hit one of these guys in the proton. Now, of course, gamma is coupled to electric charge, therefore what directly sits in this formula are quark densities, but starting from this point on, I will talk about gluons, but still we'll sort of from time to time refer to a similar imaginary formula which contains gluon density there. So that's all very good for when X is not very low, X being inversely proportional to the center of mass energy of the gamma star P subsystem in this collision. But when X gets slower, smaller and smaller, things become more complicated. And the reason for that, of course, is each one of these partons here carries color. So that means that there are some fluctuations around it, some gluons that are created and go back to the vacuum, sort of flash around each one of these partons. Now, these gluons are not seen by the probe if they're very fast, fastly changing. But when one goes to low X, that essentially means that we boost this proton. And when we boost this proton, this little gluon cloud cools down, right, due to time dilation. And so these gluons become quasi-real, and then they will be seen in the scattering processes at this lower X. So this is what happens. We start with something like this, with a small number of partons, and then as we lower X, these partons swell. They are getting dressed by this cold gluon cloud. And so at some point, the gluons start overlapping with each other, interacting with each other, and one gets a system of high partonic density, which cannot be described any longer as a system of dilute system of small non-interacting partons. Parenthetically, of course, as in contrast with that, when we go to higher Q squared, the number of partons also grows, but it grows in a completely different way because they become smaller in size. So the number grows, but density doesn't. So low X picture is really very, very different from that. So the question is, how does it actually grow? How does this gluon cloud grow with X, with energy? How does it evolve? And within the context of simple perturbative QCD, the answer is known, and the answer is given by the so-called BFKL equation. Now, I'm not going to write it down, but I want to discuss its solution a little bit. So it's an equation for this quantity phi, which is the density of gluons with momentum k at a given impact parameter. And the equation is a linear evolution equation, so d phi by dt, where t is log x, or rapidity, is you know some linear kernel and then phi here. So that just tells you the linearity of this equation, that sort of evolution is completely independent. The extra gluons that you produce are proportional to the number of gluons that you had in the previous rapidity beam. Now the solution of this equation is known, and it's asymptotic form at large t modulo all kinds of pre-exponential factors, which I'm not worried about, looks like this. So this phi of k and b is exponential. An exponential of t rapidity with some numerical factor here, which is given here, minus there is some momentum and impact parameter dependence, which sits in this factor here. And there are two very notable features of this expression. First of all, of course, if you look at what happens at small impact parameters, at small impact parameters, density grows exponentially. So this, okay, this never diverges really. So a small impact parameter just means that I'm taking this to be of order smaller than one. And so then at which region is bounded by diffusion radius, which scales with t as exponential of square root of t. So if you look within this diffusion radius, the gluon density at large rapidities is exponentially large. Now one immediate consequence of this is that if I use the simple deep inelastic type formula for gluon probe, that would mean that this solution violates unitarity, because what I have to do to calculate the cross section, I have to integrate this phi of b over impact parameter, and then of course, because in the central region this phi is exponentially large, I get that the cross section grows exponentially, and that clearly violates Froissart bound that tells me that it cannot grow faster than square of t. Now this is really the main problem, and this is the main non-unitary behavior of the BFKL equation. There is actually another source of violation of unitarity in BFKL equation, which within BFKL framework is subleading, but nevertheless is physically very distinct and I think very interesting. And that is just that this wave function or this density swells, it grows in the impact parameter space. If I look at impact parameters which are not inside this diffusion radius, but actually fairly far away from it, at exponentially large distances, exponentially with t, I do have to put here some epsilon, which is a small number, otherwise my formula here breaks down. But I still can do it for impact parameters of this sort. Then I find that the gluon density at these large distances is still exponentially large, as long as this epsilon is small enough. Now it doesn't mean that, I mean, eventually it of course decreases, and the contribution to cross section in fact from this region are subleading relatively to the diffusion radius, but nevertheless these contributions themselves are also exponentially large, so they also break unitarity. Now we usually don't bother about it in the framework of BFKL equation just because this source is leading and is more worrisome. But in some sense it's also much easier to deal with this one, because what it really tells us is that the way we're calculating probability is not right. This tells us that the probability for scattering within this BFKL framework at the central impact parameter is actually greater than one. Now that of course doesn't make sense. And the problem with that is that we're just double counting, because what we are in a situation where this is a dense system, so any probe that comes in scatters not once, but maybe twice, three or four times. And if this is the case, then clearly the probability for scattering is not proportional to the number of gluons. This character here has to saturate, where this can pile up in principle as high as it wants to. So in a dense system, the scattering probability is not proportional to the number of gluons. It has to saturate at one, and we do have to take into account this if we want to understand how this system, how this system of gluons, this gluon cloud evolves in X. And here is where this wonderful magic CGC comes in. Now, I like this abbreviation a lot, because it's kind of symmetric and it's also a musical phrase. So I think it must be true. But I'm not so sure about this part of this expansion of it. I don't know. Color glass sounds sort of too fragile. So when I'm at home, you know, alone at night, thinking about this problem, I refer to it as cold gluon cloud, which has the same abbreviation as that one. So there's been a lot of work, whatever the name you prefer to call it. There's been a lot of work in the last 5, 6, 7 years on this problem. And there are people did come up with equations that resum this multiple scattering these multiple scattering contributions, and therefore go beyond the simple BFKL equation. In particular, there are two such sets of equations, I should say. The first one was derived by Baletsky and then by Yurikov-Chegov in the large NC limit fairly later, and has been rederived many times with various people since. And in terms of diagrams, this is the equation of sums, the so-called fan diagrams. Now, that doesn't really matter. I will discuss it in what I consider to be a little bit more physical terms later. Now, there is another equation which was derived in 97 by Jamal, who is here, Herbert Weigert, Andrei Leonidov, and myself. And that one goes beyond a BK equation. So I'll refer to this one BK and this one BBK, who stand for beyond BK, in that it sums fan diagrams, but it also sums Pomeron loops in principle. Now, this equation is more complicated, and so during recent years there's been a lot of numerical and analytical effort to understand this particular one. So that's what I will start my discussion with. We still don't know, okay, we know very little about the behavior in this equation, and we don't, well, I'll come back to this problem, but I will refer to it again towards the end of my talk. So let me just give you a flavor. What is this BK equation? How does one derive it? And what physics does it contain? Now, to do that, let me consider a system, a similar system to deep inelastic scattering, but let's abstract ourselves from the fact that the photon has distribution of dipole sizes, and I will consider a scattering of a single dipole, QQ bar dipole, on some target. Now, for this purpose, I consider the target to be large, so that the scattering probability of this dipole on a target, this n, is not a small number, is not order alpha, so we are already in this region where multiple scatterings are important. Now, so this is the starting point. At some initial rapidity, this is what we have. We have this dipole that hits the target and scatters with some probability n. Now, as we lower x, we can think of it in the frame in which it is the projectile that is boosted rather than the target, the so-called dipole frame. So what happens in this frame is the dipole wave function evolves. When we boost it, it emits an extra gluon. Now, the origin of this extra gluon is nothing but the Coulomb field that was sitting there around this Q and Q bar, which was not sort of did not contain gluons. But once it is boosted, it some components of it become transverse. And we know exactly what components. One gets this Weizsäcker-Williams field, which is the transverse part of it. So this extra gluon is emitted with an amplitude which is proportional to the Weizsäcker-Williams field of, well, either the quark or the anti-quark. And of course, well, I screwed up here a little bit. It should be G rather than alpha S in the amplitude. But in any case, the probability, therefore, to have this extra gluon in the wave function after boost goes like alpha S times this factor here when I sum these two guys and square them, essentially. Now, in large NC limit, this can be understood in terms of Müller's dipoles in a very simple way, because a gluon in terms of its color structure in large NC limit is the same as a quark and anti-quark pair. So this diagram is equivalent to this one, and this is equivalent to that one. But then if you look at it, you see that this is nothing but two dipoles. So we started with one dipole at x and y, and we end up with two dipoles and at x and z, and z and y. Okay, so this is the final state of this one little step in the evolution. What is the probability for scattering of this two-dipole state? Well, this is what it is. If we have two dipoles, then the total probability is this one here. So it's the sum of the probability for scattering for the first, plus for the second, and minus the thing that we double overcount if we just sum those two, because, of course, in these events, there's a probability where both scattered, and those events have to be counted once. But if we just add those two, they are counted twice, so we subtract them. Now, and that's basically the end of the story. That's the end of the derivation of BK equation, because once you have that, you can write what is the change of the scattering probability of a single dipole as you go to lower x or higher t, and that's the equation. So this is precisely the probability of having one extra gluon that we had on the previous transparency. These three terms are precisely the terms that I had before. And now there is one extra term, which is a virtual correction, which basically just takes care of the fact that the projectile wave function stays normalized. If I started with a normalized wave function, they created a new one extra gluon, then the component which doesn't have this gluon has smaller weight. So this is this subtraction here. So now you look at this equation, and it makes you sort of happy. It makes you happy because you see immediately that in this equation, the scattering probability cannot go beyond 1. So if you take n equals to 1 and put it in the right-hand side of this equation, it vanishes, which means that it just cannot go further than that. So n definitely saturates in this equation. And that's very nice. Now, how exactly does it saturate? We know it approximately. Well, we know from numerical studies, and we know from some analytic approximations. I should say that all of them were done essentially in the translationally invariant, in the transverse plane approximation, which is assuming that all our dipoles, all of them that play any role of importance in this equation, have smaller size than impact parameter. So we think of a large target, small dipole here, but importantly, not only this dipole is small, but also this point Z does not go too far away from the initial dipole here. So that, we are sure though that in some region this approximation is good. In particular, it should be good for a description of the system close to the saturation region. So qualitatively, the result of this study, let me just very, very roughly summarize them. One can think of this n of x and y, the scattering probability of a dipole at points x and y, as 1 minus this type of exponential. So that's x minus y squared times saturation momentum. The saturation momentum depends on rapidity. Now you look at this formula, well, when you're talking about small dipoles, of course, you don't expect to be saturated, and you expect them to have a cross-section which is normal perturbative cross-section, and indeed it does. You expand this, and this is what you get. So this saturation momentum is just proportional to the gluon density in this approximation, alpha s and c times gluon density in the input parameter plane. Whereas at large momentum, of course, n goes to 1. The exponential dies, so for pairs of size larger, than QS, right. So, as for saturation momentum itself, we know from these calculations that it grows exponentially with rapidity. So the question is, does it answer all the questions that we wanted it to answer? And the answer to this question about the question is no, that it doesn't. And the reason it doesn't satisfy us completely is because the total cross-section still does not unitarize here. Because again, to calculate total cross-section, we have to integrate the probability of scattering over the impact parameter plane. Now we started with some dipole here. During this evolution, it was growing. I told you that it was growing. I didn't tell you yet how, but it certainly was growing. So if it didn't hit the target before evolution, once it becomes large enough, it will hit the target. And therefore, the question is really how this size of the projectile grows with rapidity in this approximation. To satisfy Frost-Arr bound, it should at most grow linearly with t. However, it doesn't. And the reason it doesn't here is because the evolution of the projectile wave function is completely linear. And that you can see because I was discussing this evolution of one single dipole, and I never told you that there could be some other dipoles in the wave function. So each one of them just evolves and knows nothing about its friends and relatives, which are sitting there beside it. So, and this is an exact statement. It's not maybe completely clear from what I told you so far, but it is true that the density of dipoles in the projectile wave functions in this evolution satisfies just simple BFKL equation. So this quantity n, which is the dipole density, density of dipoles of size x at impact parameter b, which come from initial dipole of some size x naught, satisfies at large t has this form, which is very much like the form that I wrote for you before, except with some little extra term. And so exactly by the same argument as before, you see that if I go to large impact parameters, the density of these dipoles is still very large, if the energy is large. And the radius at which this density large is again, as previously, grows exponentially with t. So we start with this poor little dipole of the size x naught. After a lot of evolution, it swells and it swells exponentially, and then even if the target was far away in the impact parameter, eventually it hits it. And okay, I won't go into details of how you estimate this radius. It's really a very trivial thing, but this is the estimate of the radius. So you see that the maximum radius is exponential in t with some coefficient, which from the formula I wrote down you can actually calculate. And numerically you find that it is just a little bit smaller, but not very much, from the leading BFKL exponential behavior. Now I should say numerical value here is not reliable because the expression I was using was only approximate, but there are some, as it turns out, early numerical studies of that, and they actually show that the real number is something like 0.75, so not that far from this rough estimate. So what does it tell us? Well, it tells us that at large enough rapidity, even a small projectile swelled to very large radius, right? And at rapidities where this radius is larger than the radius of the target, clearly further evolution is certainly non-unitary. And so this sets the limit of the applicability of BK equation at this rapidity where R naught over X naught is the ratio of the target to a projectile radii. Okay, now is this bad news? Well, I don't know. In some sense, it's not news at all, because all this growth and swelling is due to Coulomb fields. And we know, of course, the theory is confining. So at some point, this perturbative growth will stop due to confining forces. And so in this respect, this behavior is just completely unphysical. But it's interesting that even within perturbation theory, before you go further to confinement, there are effects which will slow down this growth. Because, as I told you, the BK equation does not take into account Pomeron loops, or another way of saying it, it does not take into account that when the density in the projectile becomes large enough, the partons in the projectile interact with each other. So evolution of the projectile wave function will not be linear. And it will not be linear starting, one can estimate this, so starting at rapidities of this kind of value, which is smaller than the previous rapidity that I have quoted. So wave function saturation effects of or Pomeron loops effect will certainly slow down this further growth. We know that it must slow it down. It cannot speed it up. We don't know by how much. So again, here I should say that the equation that sums them exists, but it has not been analyzed yet. So you can ask, maybe could they unitarize actually the whole thing? Okay, right. I think I'll manage. What do these Pomeron loops do? Can they actually unitarize the cross section? Well, I think it's extremely unlikely that they will actually unitarize. They certainly will slow down this growth. But for them to unitarize, they really have to cut off the tails, the perturbative tails, because what we are dealing here with is, whatever you say, are perturbative massless gluons. And so any charge distribution that you have will have some multiple moment. And this multiple moment will always create power-like tails outside the bulk. And you know by this beautiful Heisenberg's argument that if you have power tails, the total cross-section will be always exponential in rapidity. Let me just flash this argument because I think it's so illuminating. So suppose this is the target, and the target has some density in the impact parameter, rho of b. Now we hit it with a probe. Now for inelastic event to happen, the energy that is stored in the overlap of the probe and the target has to be greater than the mass of the lowest mass particle in the system, so in this case a pion. So the highest impact parameter one can go to have an inelastic scattering event, therefore has to satisfy that S times rho, which is the energy, total energy in this little region, has to be equal to m pi. So if rho of b, if this profile, density of profile is exponential, then inverting this equation, we have that the maximal radius, in fact, is logarithmic in S, and the square of it, which is a cross-section, is therefore saturated for SAR bound. But if it is a power, any power, then the maximal radius also goes as a power of energy. And therefore, if there are any kind of power tails, this will not work. The unitarization will not work. Now, but I say that maybe this is not bad news. Maybe it's actually good news. Because the possibility that I want to raise is that maybe that this growth is what we call soft Pomeron. Now, this may sound as very bizarre, I don't know. To some people maybe it sounds like very natural, but I want to make this point. We look at this completely perturbative argument, and we see that perturbation theory furnishes two completely distinct physical mechanisms for growth of cross-section as exponential of the rapidity. One is due to the growth of density. So that for small systems which start off as dilute and not dense, this will dominate the initial evolution. And that goes with, let's say, BFKL exponential 0.4, and that we associate with hard Pomeron. Now, there is another mechanism which is subleading for these dilute systems, but which is leading for black systems. So if our system is black and dense, then the growth, further growth of the density does not affect cross-section. But what affects cross-section is this growth of the transverse size. And now this, as I showed you, also grows exponentially as a power of energy. We don't know this power. All we know that it is smaller than the BFKL power. And this is, so I think this is a very interesting possibility which one has to explore. Could it be that perturbation theory itself gives us mechanism for hard and soft Pomeron? And maybe these guys are the two Pomerons that I use to fit the data. It would really be nice. And it would be nice, I mean, you know, there's this perfectly good perturbative mechanism. It would be a waste to not to use it, right? In some sense. And also, then what, you know, you wouldn't need to call for some non-perturbative phenomena to generate this power growth of the soft cross-sections. They would only, this soft phenomena, this non-perturbative phenomena, come in the higher asymptotics to unitarize this growth. So I think this is quite interesting. Of course, the obvious caveat of it is that if the system is large, it cannot be perturbative. So the only way this can work is that our proton or any given hadron is not all of it black, of course, because if it has a huge radius, but can consist of small black objects. And this is where I think it connects somehow to Bryan-Stok. So my picture is that the proton is really three small black constituent quarks of radius of, let's say, 0.3 Fermi. Then if this system would evolve in energy according to this soft exponential. Now, I mean, I don't know I don't have much to say about it, except that there's some very simple arithmetic that I can do and see that the numbers that you get for the total cross section is not completely off the scale. So you get, if you take this radius 0.3 Fermi, you get for this cross section something like 40, 50 millibar, which is just about right. So sigma p pi over sigma pp is 2/3, which is fine. And also what you expect, for example, that sigma elastic over sigma total would be far from the black disk limit of 1/2, and indeed it's something like 1/5, so roughly consistent. So maybe. And the interesting thing, again, I stress that if yes, then soft Pomeroy intercept should be calculable perturbatively from this nonlinear equation that I didn't write down for you, but which exists. Right. Thank you.
There are questions. Okay, let's start with you.
So in your argument, you have used a lot of constraint from unitarity and the probability of scattering in describing the saturation of gluon density at small x, right?
Right.
And so now I forward back to part on jet fermentation E plus minus. So in this case, I think this argument will not apply. And how do you think this kind of same kind of physics will apply to parton fermentation in plus
or
minus?
Of course, parton fragmentation is completely different kinematics, right? Here I'm talking about the wave function which is sitting there and had infinite time to develop. And in fragmentation, you start with some bare something, whatever it is, quark, right? And then you evolve it in time and see how it evolves. Now, dynamics may be similar. I mean, I don't know. In some sense, it is the same wave function that you develop. So there may be similarity, but technically, I wouldn't know. Okay, I mean, I would know what to do, but I wouldn't know how to do it, right? You should start with this small thing and evolve it with QCD Hamiltonian and see what wave function as a function of time you get. I mean, it's tough, but. And not completely inconceivable, perturbatively.
Can you give some values of X at RIC or LAC where the saturation effects become important?
Well, this saturation momentum, yes, it's very, there are no firm numbers for its estimate, but it's in the ballpark, people think, at RIC of about 1.5 GeV, let's say. At LHC, it will be around, 3, I think, is the values. I guess Raju will talk about it in more detail. So.
I would like to draw the attention to this discrepancy between the BFKL or the improved BFKL of 0.7 to the experimental value of 0.4. There's a very large discrepancy of the perturbative calculation. This has been tried to be improved by the next to leading order calculation. This has even made things worse. So up to now, the next to leading order calculation of BFKL is also not on very good experimental grounds. Now, we have tried a very different route, looking at the lattice and at this collection of C quarks, comparing it to Wilson line dynamics on the lattice in a reduced theory of 2+1 dimensions. And the symmetry of SU3, which is here the center symmetry of SU3, the Z3 symmetry, gives an intercept which is very close to the experimental value, which can explain the F2 data, and therefore I think this should also be considered in the long run.
Well, yes, it's very interesting, except that as far as I understand from discussions with you, your exponential really corresponds to what I call here soft Pomeroy, because this is for you, this is what governs the size of the wave function. Well, I'm not sure about that. I mean, physics is different. There are two different mechanisms. As for next to leading order BFKL, well, yes, that's a mess. And of course, well, I mean, some people think that they can fix it up, right? And if they fix it up the way they fix it up, then the leading order intercept is decreased by roughly a factor of 2, not quite, but so.
Yeah, I want to start with the physical picture at the end and say that in some sense the fact that it the average grayness or blackness of nucleon actually is due to more black object which is smaller than the nucleon itself is really a fact, no matter what we think about it, because there are even direct data saying from CDF which looked at very hard processes when you produce 4 jets which are in the kinematics, that it is really 2 independent binary collisions of jets. And if you assume that partons are individually, independently distributed with the average grayness of a nucleon and calculate how much double collisions you have, you are off by a factor about 2 or more. In other words, there are black pieces inside it, and the argument with diffraction also, of course, is the old argument, yes, which tell us that. And that, by the way, also touches on what Brian was saying, that when a valence quark pick up a small x quark to become this fragmented object, it is very important that the small x quarks are not distributed randomly in the disk, and the higher density of them close to the valence guys, and that presumably will help.
Right.
Now, there is another problem. So if there are 2 different hard and soft polymerons, and there should be some different mechanisms, etc., the puzzle is, which was the puzzle from 60s, that the so-called soft polymeron still has a radius which is given by its alpha prime, which is pretty small, 0.2 Fermi or something like this. So even the soft polymeron is a small size object also. Yes. So all this physics of growth, etc., is not really swelling of the nucleon. It is swelling of these black little pieces, several times smaller than the nucleon itself. It is size of 0.2 Fermi or something
so
like
I
this.
Take it
so what are they? What is their origin, etc., is very important to understand.
No, I completely agree with that. I mean, these black, where do these small black things come from? This is non-perturbative physics of the static wave function. May very well be instantons or whatever. You thought it.
Just a question about this next to leading order corrections to BFKL, since they were computed and of course they were shown to be big and even of opposite signs, so it kind of invalidates the whole scheme. So is your scheme such that one can even think of calculating corrections to it? Is it controllable?
Yes.
And if so, but does it not suffer the same fate as BFKL, so that next to leading order corrections are big and invalidated?
Whether it does or does not suffer the same fate, we don't know, because the framework is there, and corrections to these equations of the same type as BFKL to BFKL kernel certainly can be calculated. Now, they have not been calculated, and obviously the equation has not been studied. Whether they will have the same problem or not, one can hope that they will have a little less problems, because there's a lot of problem, a lot of this large contribution in BFKL is because you have these collinear gluons. I mean, the 2 gluons which are emitted collinearly. Now, perhaps if the density is already large, this effect will be not so strong. And that's, in fact, how people try to solve this problem of large corrections, to resum these collinear emissions to all orders. I mean, I'm not an expert in this, but I've seen people do that. And if that solution works there, then I see no reason at all why it will not work here. And hopefully this will be, you know, even from the beginning, a little bit less singular than linear BFKL.
Right. Yeah, I was going to ask a question similar to what Ed asked about the interpretation of these double parton scattering events at high energies. I mean, what I understand very little from that is that the explanation is that the fluctuations of the locations of the valence quarks in the transverse plane have an effect also on the gluons. And if that's true, does that mean that there are fluctuations in the gluon configuration of the proton that would cause saturation physics to actually fluctuate from, let's say, EP scattering event to EP scattering event in a way that's not sort of in the current CGC pictures?
I am not sure. I don't know how to answer your question. What I can say, it may not be related to what you are asking, is that fluctuations are certainly there. And for example, what you expect in this picture, I mean, proton will not always have this type of configuration. So sometimes you have these color transparent, right, configurations which are small. So what you expect, for example, that for small configurations, this proton will behave, or its the cross section for this type of events will grow with hard Pomeron and not with soft Pomeron. That you certainly expect in this picture, and this seems to be sort of, you know, people that fit the data with two Pomerons do say that hard Pomeron plays a role also in these events, in the PP cross section. I mean, that's as far as I can go.
I'd like to expand a little bit on Edward's question. So the fact that the Pomeron intercept is so small, it's 1 over 4GF squared, means that you have this very large non-perturbative scale. And even if you assume that initially you have this very small black constituent quarks, this probably will not help because the slope means that the rate with which this radius increases with energy is non-perturbative. I mean, it's not the initial condition.
The rate is, I mean, the rate of this expansion is given by the growth of the total cross-section,
yes,
which is 0.08. So the radius should grow as S to the 0.04.
No, I'm not talking about the intercept. I'm talking about the slope.
No,
of
but
the
this trajectory is what determines the size of the black region. Right, it's a
no, but if you look at t-dependent differential cross-section, d sigma dt.
So that means that they become further away, yes? I mean, that I don't understand what you're saying. So that, yes, that there's certainly other soft physics there, right? I mean, something holds them together.
So you do not pretend on explaining
No. Certainly the not
growth,
this part.
The growth of diffraction.
The growth of diffraction, no. But it would be interesting what also Brian mentioned. I mean, in this picture, you can definitely define something like a diffractive quark scattering, where the whole cloud goes away. So that part, I would think, you would be able to describe perturbatively, maybe.
Yes, one more.
Yeah, in all of these calculations, you pretty much assume you're in some sort of weak coupling limit, right? Now, the question I have is, it seems like a lot of, I mean, certainly in Brian's experiment and even at Rick, that's not completely true, and yet it seems like, for instance, in these colored glass calculations, which appear to be getting some of the right answers, that you can sort of push this. Now, is there... Do you have any sense of how far it can be pushed? I mean, can it really be pushed down to the AGS kinds of energies? And if so, do you have any sense of why? Is this, are we still in a weak coupling limit or not?
Well, you know, sometimes people are lucky, right? And some good theorists most of the time are lucky. So they do calculation for weak coupling, but it also works for coupling of order one. Now, why? I don't think there is a general answer to that, and in particular in this case also, I have no idea.
The Pomeron rise of cross-section starts above AGS.
Well, no, that still doesn't matter that there won't be component.
Well, thank you. I think we'll stop now and thank Alex again.
And